From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. June 12th is a little-known annual commemoration of a day that has taken on special significance this year in particular. It's known as Loving Day, a day of celebration to mark interracial love and family, honoring the aptly named Mildred and Richard Loving, an interracial couple whose marriage successfully challenged the US's anti-miscegenation laws in 1967. But more than two decades before that Supreme Court decision, my guest's parents challenged those same racist laws by marrying one another across racial lines. Writing about it in a memoir, essayist and author E. Dolores Johnson now joins me. Her book is called Say I'm Dead, a family memoir of race, secrets, and love. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So there was a movie about the Lovings just a few years ago that might have really helped to educate Americans about the fact that it was illegal before 1967 for a black person and a white person to marry one another. Tell me about, before we get to your story, I'm wondering if you can start by reading a section from the beginning of your memoir, because this issue is very personal for you. You have a prologue that sets the stage for your memoir.
Yes. When I moved to South Carolina as a brand new, I hadn't lived in the South or known much about the South, but I found that people there couldn't figure out who I was and often would say to me, "What are you?" There was a gas station across from the office where I worked where we had an account. I go in there to fill up my car one morning before going to see clients, and the gas man is just unable to not ask me over and over what I am. He's asking me, "Are you Spanish? Are you Jewish? Are you Italian?" he says. And I'm very upset because I don't want to deal with this question. It's always there. But in talking with him about this incident, I had a nerve struck, and I'll just read a paragraph or two about that. I told him to get out of the way so that I could drive away. I didn't want to talk to him anymore. But I couldn't flee the nerve he struck. I pulled up and out from my childhood, where we lived in a flat with a coal stove, cringing from my black father when he raged about the racists on his job. And yet, people still challenged my identity and tried to place me outside of who I knew I was and is beyond the binary understanding of race in the United States. But blackness was my essence. I reveled in love jive talk, grew up to diligently object to racism. From store clerks following my husband's suspicion of stealing to corporate foot dragging on hiring blacks. With black people, my people, I could be myself, safe from harassment or having to filter myself for white people's benefit. There in that South Carolina gas station, I was black. According to my family, society's one-drop rule, and my government-issued birth certificate, it was culturally and legally ridiculous to wonder if I wasn't, because the biological fact of my birth was completely beside the point and counted for nothing. My beloved mother is white.
And my guest, E. Dolores Johnson, is reading from her book, Say I'm Dead, a family memoir of race, secrets, and love. Many people might not even realize that there were these laws. They were called anti-miscegenation laws. What exactly were these laws, and how was it that your parents married one another before it was legal to do so?
The anti-miscegenation laws were basically stating that there could be no intermarriage with white people based on a white supremacist belief that the race was pure, was superior, and couldn't be sullied with Native American blood, black blood, or any other person of color. And at one time, 28 states in the United States had anti-miscegenation laws. When my parents met in Indiana at work, they dated in secret, And it was my father who had to explain to my white mother how dangerous what they were doing was. She had had so little interaction with Black people, she didn't really know the politics and was not aware that they could be sentenced to prison, each of them, at hard labor for intermarrying. And there had been a lynching nearby in Indiana that had scared my father to death. They had it hanging up in the Black barber shop, came in for haircuts. Understand that what they were doing was extremely dangerous. They decided to run away. So my parents fled to New York State, where it was legal to marry. When the Supreme Court heard the later, there were still 15 states which had those laws, and they were overturned in that 1967 decision by the Supreme Court.
So your life as a young person, as you read in the prologue, seemed to be marked by not confusion from your end about who you were, but from society. What did that mean for a young person like yourself to see that you, as a product of a love that was, you know, for so many years just deemed illegal, that, you know, how did you see the way in which society viewed you? I mean, today we might take the issue of interracial marriage and interracial families for granted. We do celebrate them, at least most of us in this country celebrate them. But I imagine that when you were growing up, you were still considered an oddity by society.
Well, the word was abomination.
Mm.
The word was abomination. I was born in 1948 when the Dixiecrat Party was established in the South, and they very much had anti-miscegenation as part of their platform, and they called me unnatural and abominations. And this came through from people met in the street, whether we were on a ferry going to an amusement park or trying to shop, where would roll their eyes at us across the street. So we had the mixed race racism to deal with, but we also had Black racism to deal with. Because my dad, as a Black man, we lived in the ghetto, and he suffered a lot of racism as not only a Black man, but a Black man with a white wife. Mm-hmm. In 1958, when I was 10 years old, Pew Research did a study that showed that 96% of Americans were against race mixing.
Wow, that's shocking. So in what you write in your memoir, you go into the history of your father's family. Tell me a little bit about that history, because of course, while interracial marriage might have been illegal before 1967, it's not as though there weren't children of Black and white parents, because of course of the legacy of slavery and of rape, right?
Well, that's correct. I mean, when we talk about mixed race people, folks don't think about the origination of mixed race in America as slave rape. From the beginning of the United States and the colonies, there were slave rapes. And so we were called mulattoes, we were called Oreos, all kinds of misnomers, mongrels, mutts, and so on. I decided to do the genealogy of my father's family, which was the only family that we had grown up with and known anything about. And in the course of that, I went down to Alabama, to Birmingham, to meet this ancient aunt, great aunt, who I had heard of and never met. And she got out a dress box, pictures, and laid out all of these relatives, sort of heard of and didn't know how they were related, and made art on the dining table. Of our conversation, she said to me, "Oh, you know, you look just like your grandmother. You both have that white side." And I said, "What white side?" She said, "They didn't tell you? Her father was white." Now, my grandmother was born in 1890, and not a word had ever been spoken of this, but this aunt spilled all the beans. And she said, you know, her mom had a sister. Frances and Pearl were sisters who were like 14, 15, 16 years old when they were both raped by white men two brothers on a plantation in Georgia. And their issue was my grandmother and an aunt I had met who lived in Harlem called AC. And then I'd never thought either one of them had any mixed blood. And I said to my great aunt, oh my gosh, she must have been so ashamed. Is that why she didn't tell me? And she said, ashamed? What for? She didn't do anything wrong. This is what white men could always do to black women, and we had no recourse. So when I went back home to visit my mother, I asked her about all, and I said to her, did your father? She said, yes. You know, he would come every blue moon and sit on the porch with AC and I in his lap, and he brought a bag of tea. And we were there for a little while. And so you asked me why I've never spoken of him, because he means nothing to me.
What about your mother's family history? So your father was black, your mother white. I imagine that there were some conversations around her family history as well.
Of course, we did not know anything about my mother's family. That is a question people always ask me. How could you not know anything? But we didn't talk about any of that. And it was just given that my mother was our white family all by herself. And after I did my father's genealogy and I spread out this big chart I had made, it struck me one day looking at it that there was only one white person on there, and that she had to have a family. She had to be from somewhere. I was an adult at the time, an executive in a corporation. And I thought, well, I have to know who these people are and what this means. Like, now I'm totally destabilized in my personality because I went to a black university, Howard University. I married a black man. I was a staunch member of a black Baptist church. I was a Motown dancer. I couldn't understand what was happening.
So you write in your book about bringing those two sides of your family together. What was that like? What was the resistance to it?
I went home to talk to my family. They didn't know I had an agenda, but we all had dinner together. And I had a brother who was a black militant and a suspected was passing for white with his white wife across the other side of town. And all of us were there together. And I said, you know, our white family is missing. They have always been missing. And people were so upset. They didn't want to talk about it. My mother was so disturbed. She caught her breath. She jerked up in her chair. My father took her upstairs to talk to her. And we waited upstairs, my brothers and I, for more than an hour before they came down. And for the first time in our lives, my mother said to us, I ran away from my family. And I never meant for them to find me. And they never have. So I wanted to go and find her family and look at them. I just wanted to see whose blood was in my veins. And my mother was dead set against it. She cried and she said, I'm too ashamed of having run off and left them 36 years. They think I'm sure they do. And, you know, I could tell them for what I did. And I said, I want who I am. I really, really, really have to do this, but I can leave you out of it. But just tell me, if I meet them, what am I supposed to say about you? He said, say I'm dead.
Wow. That's the title of your book.
Yes. I actually went to look for them. It was pre-internet, pre-ancestry.com. And so it was all by paper and shoe leather that I went and studied vital records in Indianapolis and walked the neighborhood and called the church and did all these things to try and find my relatives. And I had only been there, you know, for a morning when I discovered that my mother's parents were both dead. And she had them frozen in her mind, thinking, she told me, when you see dad, you know, memorize everything so you can tell me exactly what he looks like. And so the search went on then for her sister. And I didn't find her. I went to the airport to leave, And I called the church back to ask one more time if they found anything, and they had. And so I called the woman in the phone book who matched the name that they had. She had married a GI during World War II, and his name I found. When I called her, she answered. And I said to her, "You don't know me, but I would like to ask you some questions to see if you're the person I'm looking for." And she reluctantly agreed. Asked her some questions about her father. His name was Henry Lewis. They lived on Woodlawn Avenue. They went to a certain church. He was an electrician. All of this, she said, yes, yes, yes. And then I said, "You had a sister that went missing in the early 40s. And I heard her catch her breath, and she couldn't speak. And then she said, "Yes." And I said, "Her name was Myrna Elizabeth." And she said, "No." I didn't know what to do. I was frozen. So I just went back over the same questions. And when I got to the end, I said, "Her nickname is Ella." She said, "Yes, yes, that's my sister, Ella. But who are you?" And I said, "I am Ella's daughter." She told me to wait where I was in the airport. She was coming.
Wow.
She didn't ask me what gait, what are you wearing, what do you look like. Nothing. She hung up. And this is before TSA, so you have this crowd of people coming and going up and down the corridor, and see this woman with gray hair down the concourse, and her eyes are fixed. And she walks up to me, and she says, "Who isn't it? I see my sister in your face."
So that began, I'm assuming, a sort of reconciliation, at least between you and your mother's side of the family, the white side of the family?
It was, you know, we talked for about an hour. And at the end, I would say that we were both in shock. It wasn't gleeful and it wasn't ugly, which is what my militant brother had predicted, that they would, you know, shut the door in my face and call me names. Because I was Black, and because my mother had married a Black man. But when we left, we exchanged information, and it took a while before the next contact took place, because my mother practically had a breakdown when I told her all of this, that I had spoken to her sister, and the things that her sister had told me, and that we had shared, and pictures we had looked at together, and so forth. But there was a reconciliation that happened sometime later. Yes.
I will leave it to our audience to pick up a copy of your book and read the details of the memoir. But I want to sort of step back and ask you to reflect on the current political moment that we're in today, where Americans are really thinking about how this country has treated Black people. Not only are we, of course, protesting racist police brutality, but there's also the destruction of racist statues, of statues celebrating, Confederate leaders. And there's so much sort of reckoning that is happening right now, and that actually seemed to happen quite quickly. But this is a story, I suppose, that's as old as the nation itself, or at least the formal United States of America. How are you viewing, given who you are, given the book you've written, your family, how are you viewing what is unfolding in the United States today?
Well, I feel it's about time. There's a tinderbox that has been smoldering for a very long time among Black and brown people in this country about how we're treated. It's not just being having the police called on you for sleeping on the dorm couch at Yale or watching the birds, or even the police with their knee on your neck, because we all tell our children to beware every time they step out the door that they could be shot and jailed for the most nothing reasons. But, you know, the root cause of the outrage that's in the street is the systemic racism in the United States. It is so ingrained in the marrow of America's thinking. The segregated neighborhoods, the lack of opportunity for justice and health care, the people who cross the street because they see a Black person, the woman in Central Park who calls the police in hysterics and says a Black man threatening her life when all he's doing is asking her to leash her dogs. This is the behavior that white people don't see. They have a part to fix, but they absolutely must participate in changing all of this systemic racism if we're going to get anywhere further.
Well, Dolores, I want to join. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me, Sonali. It's my pleasure.
My guest has been E. Dolores Johnson. She's an essayist and author. We've been discussing her memoir, Say I'm Dead, a family memoir of race, secrets, and love. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.